she failed all her in-hospital hearing tests. And despite the fact that CMV is the most statistically likely cause of that, since we had no history of genetic hearing loss in our families, no one mentioned it and no one tested her for CMV. And I was just in this bubble of dark silence. It was just like, she was quiet. She wouldn't even make sound to nurse. She would paw at me. And so it was just this like other experience of infancy that I had not had with my firstborn. I just knew deep down that something was different. And when we went to the pediatrician at 10 days old, he said, I want to test her for this common but little known virus called CMV.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
I'm Megan Nix. I'm the author of Remedies for Sorrow, An Extraordinary Child, A Secret Kept from Pregnant Women, and A Mother's Pursuit of the Truth. I'm also a mother of 5 children. This is Sylvia and me.
Megan, thank you so much for being with me here today. And we're going to talk about a topic that is so important. And in the title of your book, it says, A Secret Kept from Pregnant Women. When you were pregnant in 2015, I believe, with your second daughter, your second child, Anna, you had a toddler at the time, your firstborn daughter. And when you gave birth to Anna, she was small and she couldn't hear. It turns out she was deaf, and you learn out quite soon after that she has CMV, which is cytomegalovirus. It's a congenital, and it's a very, it's a contagious disease, which you probably got from your toddler. Can you tell us why something like this, it's not widely known as some of the other things that we test pregnant women for? Why is that so?
So CMV is actually the leading cause of birth defects in the United States. So our daughter was born deaf, as you said, and had gross motor delays. But CMV also can cause blindness, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, stillbirth, and early infant death. And so it's really a virus that if you're pregnant and you catch it, it can really damage all development in the fetus. And once we had Anna and we received her diagnosis, this sent me down a path of intense research once I realized the prevalence of CMV and its silence. So where, like you said, toxoplasmosis is one of those congenital infections that most women know about during pregnancy statistically. It's well known as the kitty litter disease. That affects 1 in 10,000 newborns, but CMV affects 1 in 200 newborns, and the vast majority of people have never heard of it. So I went down this rabbit hole of research to understand why, and that's when I realized it really deserved an entire book to explore the reasons that this is not voiced by obstetricians. One main reason is that ACOG, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they do not recommend that doctors discuss it with pregnant women. And that's because, as you said, CMV is primarily transmitted through toddlers. So it's actually present in about 1 out of 3 toddlers, and daycares happen to be rife with CMV. About 80% of children in daycare will get a postnatal CMV infection within 2 years of being at daycare. And so, as you can imagine, this is, you know, not ideal information. And ACOG says that knowing about this and knowing some preventive measures, which are actually very simple and quite successful in studies, which is just to not kiss your toddler on the lips when you're pregnant, to not finish their snacks when you're pregnant. All the other times, it's fine, unless you're undergoing an organ transplant. CMV is really no more than a common cold. But during pregnancy, we should be told about these simple measures. So I think that doctors are hesitant to adopt this conversation because of the amount of questions that it will spin off for, you know, your general patient at an OB appointment who's 8 weeks pregnant and finds out that they have never heard of the leading cause of birth defects. That's kind of a bomb to drop. And unfortunately, I think it's a medical embarrassment, and it's been hidden for so long that it is now something that is sort of put upon us as CMV parents to educate other people about, instead of for doctors to educate them about. Another big issue with CMV is that doctors in studies have been shown to be significantly deficient in their understanding of CMV, in their understanding of the transmission routes and its treatment in newborns after birth. So we're talking about a systemic void of information. And that's why I started writing the book. I just couldn't believe it. It was confounding.
Well, the other thing is that doctors have what's called therapeutic privilege. And as you said, there are some very simple things that a pregnant woman can do, such as washing their hands frequently, kind of like what we did with COVID before we understood that it couldn't be transmitted through touch. Yet they, in their wisdom, hold back on that because they don't want to. They feel that a woman, you know, they're pregnant. Why give them anything more to worry about?
Right.
And that is like taking away from us. And by, you know, the end result is having a child with CMV and not giving you the chance to do what you could do just by doing something as simple as washing, just knowledge. And right. Again, it's this whole thing of making decisions for us instead of letting us make the decisions. The other thing you talk about is narrative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that is so that we can see what the difference between therapeutic privilege and doctors being taught competence? How would narrative medicine actually work?
So throughout raising Anna, and, you know, we had a lot of therapies, a lot of different specialists, and I started to really notice the difference between the providers who spent intimate time with us and who really wanted to know about our family and who wanted to talk to our older daughter about her experience of her sister's illness and her developmental challenges. And it really felt like we were making progress objectively more with these providers in like a measurable way in Anna's life than we were with the doctors, who were very quick and fairly dismissive. And I started to think, you know, through the process of writing my book, like, what am I really looking at here? What I'm looking at is this absence of the CMV narrative in medicine. But when I looked at it with broader strokes, it really seemed like narrative in general was missing from a lot of our experience of medicine. And that was, you know, this opportunity to be seen as a whole person. So I started to research narratives in medicine shortly after this one moment where a doctor, she was a neonatologist, who initially was pretty against implementing changes at her hospital to test newborns for CMV, despite the fact that there's a successful treatment for symptomatic babies right after birth. And I went to this dinner that she hosted after she was sort of persuaded by months worth of me sending her studies. And she looked at me and she said, if you could say one way that your providers failed you as a woman being pregnant with a child with CMV, what would that be? And it was just this profound moment of humility and vulnerability for her to say in front of this room packed full of physicians, where have we gone wrong? And so I looked into this idea of narrative in medicine, and it turns out there's this whole field called narrative medicine. And I think it's picking up speed, but it's still not as executed in the doctor-patient relationship as it could be. And basically, there was a doctor named Dr. Rita Sharon, who finished her PhD at Columbia. She was actually a practicing physician and teaching at Columbia. And she read a book at home called The Wings of the Dove by Henry James. And it moved her so deeply, this passage about a patient who is paid deep attention to by the doctor in the story, that Dr. Sharon turned right around, went back to Columbia, and got her PhD in literature. And her stance is that if we and if doctors listen to the alien perspectives of others, and they understand through literature how to discuss the uncertainty of other people's stories, and they see them as this deep character. And then I think this is the most beautiful thing. Doctors and med students who are now in these classes of narrative medicine, instead of asking the patient's chief complaint, they ask them to tell their whole story. And Dr. Sharon says when she first does this, her patients, most of them end up weeping because they've never had the opportunity in a clinical setting or otherwise to start as a whole person and to be seen as this person. And so the doctor also in this program, the medical student or the fellow or the resident or whatever, they, instead of writing in clinical notation form, they actually write in literary form, and they write in their notes in clinic the narrative of that patient as though they are a writer, as though the doctor is a poet or a journalist or a memoir writer. And so the language around that patient changes from man with back pain to man of tremendous courage. And it opens this pathway of discovery, not only for the patient, but for the doctor. And so I really saw that, you know, that's an opportunity in medicine, not only to heal this deep historical wound of CMV, but to really reform the entire field of medicine itself.
Well, the doctor then gets to see the whole patient, not right. just the back pain or the ear pain or the headache. They get to see the whole person, which is, it makes such a difference. There's been so many studies on that, and it makes a huge bit of difference. I know that in your second trimester, you had a cold, which you describe in the book that it felt like mono. Mm-hmm. And your doctor just really put you off and basically said to you, if you're that sick, you shouldn't come in.
Right.
With a cold. But he didn't ask anything else. Mm-hmm. He just assumed you had a cold and that's it. And you're a pregnant woman and you're just going to complain. And, if, you know, why get the office sick? Can you go through when Anna was born? She weighed 5 pounds. Mm-hmm. But the nurses were telling you everything was okay, but somehow you knew that there was something not okay.
Right.
And that started you on this trajectory to where you are now. With your advocacy, with your book, with Anna, and this, you know, I could be telling the last chapter where she is mainstreamed, and you, after the book was published, you had your fifth child. How did you go about insisting that you knew there was something wrong? And then finding out what it was, what it is.
Yeah, one thing that was really striking to me is I saw her smallness right away, but even before that, I heard her silence. She was born without sound. And anecdotally, a lot of babies born with CMV are born silent, which I think is kind of beautiful and kind of painful, which sort of is a good way to describe the spectrum of the entire disease. And I think, you know, in her case, she had not heard sound in utero. And so sound was not a natural component to her being right off the bat. And for me, as a hearing parent, that really rang this deep gong, this alarm bell inside my heart and in my gut. And that feeling is what guided me and directed me through the writing of the book. As I started to learn about CMV, so she wasn't tested in the hospital. CMV is also the leading cause of deafness in the world outside of genetic causes. And so the doctors and the hearing technicians in the hospital, today it's mandatory to have a child's hearing tested before they leave the hospital. That didn't used to be the case, but 98% of babies are now tested before they go home. And she failed all her in-hospital hearing tests. And despite the fact that CMV is the most statistically likely cause of that, since we had no history of genetic hearing loss in our families, no one mentioned it and no one tested her for CMV. And I was just in this bubble of dark silence. It was just like, she was quiet. She wouldn't even make sound to nurse. She would paw at me. And so it was just this like other experience of infancy that I had not had with my firstborn. I just knew deep down that something was different. And when we went to the pediatrician at 10 days old, he said, I want to test her for this common but little known virus called CMV. And I think part of me was in denial, just because often when it's a viral infection that you haven't heard of, you think, no, this can't really be that common. Like, I've read all the literature. I've known the best practices of pregnancy. I would have known about it. And I think there's also just some like othering with public health issues. Like, that's something for people who are less clean or less educated. And so I was in some sort of denial, but as the days went on, I was like, and when I was reading about it, I was like, I bet you she has this. And so we got the diagnosis when she was 2 weeks old. And from that point forward, that intuitive feeling then became this deep-seated drive to encourage and demand awareness that if we are, you know, not voicing this preventable, life-threatening disease, then something is wrong. And this is an urgent issue globally. One of the doctors that I interviewed said that around 540,000 babies in India are born every year with CMV. And one out of five will suffer from lifelong impairments, no matter what country these children are born in. But differently than here, a child who is born deaf or who is epileptic in other countries, these children are not going to be cared for the same way. They are not going to have early intervention. They are not going to have access to cochlear implants like our daughter did. And so really, this is a far-reaching issue of preventable, life-altering consequences. So that feeling that began as like maternal insight, I think, was initially dismissed as this trope of like the hysteric woman. And it isn't, you know, it's if this is a disease that needs to be paid attention to, that needs to be happening on the policy level, on the hospital level, and on the human level, that these issues of the heart are urgent and often right on point.
And as you said, even though it is one of the leading causes of deafness and other disabilities, whether it be blindness, you were able to get the information because you were able to have the wherewithal to want to find out what this is, what you could do for your daughter. And there was a medicine that she could, that she needed to get within a certain period of time. I believe it was the first 4 weeks of life. And what we haven't mentioned is that you live in both Colorado and Alaska. And you were in Alaska at that time. And tell us a little bit about not just getting the medication, and the pharmacist and the pilot who got you the medication. But I'd also like to hear about your discussions with the insurance company who kept telling you they never heard of it before.
Yeah. So while we have a very challenging and interesting lifestyle, it definitely can serve as an analogy for any family who's dealing with a serious diagnosis in a rural location and the lack of access to resources that really needs to be thought through. And in general, like our providers and our therapists, they were very good at bridging that gap. But initially, so we were in Denver when I went to that pediatrician who said, let's test her. And my husband is a fisherman for a living in a town called Sitka in Southeast Alaska. And he was already in Alaska when I gave birth to Anna. We had decided because my firstborn, she was born by C-section, and I did not want to have an elective C-section for my second. The recovery was just difficult for me, and I wanted a chance at a non-surgical labor. So I said, I'll stay in Denver where I can attempt a VBAC, a vaginal birth after a C-section, and you go to Alaska. But the plan was for me to fly right up to Alaska with my mom and the baby and my toddler, assuming everything would be fine, which is just kind of a misconception in general about building a family. Like, pregnancy is never zero risk. And I think that is sort of what inhibits our conversations around it, is like this facade that you can plan all the right things and you can avoid diversity. And that's just not the case. And so that's part of the messaging of CMV prevention, is that like you can do all this stuff and it might happen anyways. And part of my book is showing the richness of life with a child who was different than we ever imagined. Anyways, we had her tested in Denver and the pediatrician said, yes, you should fly up to Alaska to be with your husband in case you get this news. So I flew up with my mom and my girls and we're on an island. You can only reach it by plane or by boat. And there's one hospital and we received her diagnosis and I had no access to a specialty pharmacy, to any specialists, even the audiologist there had no, you know, equipment that was sophisticated enough to really assess her hearing. And so, so this prescription that a baby needs to take to stop the progression of the virus in the brain and prevent future brain damage needs to be started within the first month of life. And by the time we got everything, you know, figured out, by the time I got her to the pediatrician in Alaska, who was wonderful, who was such an example of narrative medicine, you know, and I think that is like rural medicine can really be a profound example of slowness and holistic approach to the family, to the environment, to, you know, all the factors that influence health in every family. And so he said, we're going to have to gold streak that medication here. And I was like, what is gold streak? This sounds like a thriller movie. And he was like, that means we have to fly it here on a small plane because it's going to come from the Midwest and it's going to have to remain at a certain temperature. So we needed to get here fast. And so this is all in the book, obviously, but it was this crazy, just convoluted scheme that we put into place to get this medicine there as quickly as possible. And we did receive it, but less than 10% of babies are ever diagnosed with CMV who have it, which means that even fewer are actually treated for it. And so we were very privileged and very fortunate that we were able to give her that medication on time. And I think Alaska just sort of was this metaphor that didn't make as much sense in my life until I had Anna, that it is worth it to sit in this place of like isolation and challenge and see what grows from it. And certainly her diagnosis with CMV, while it's a diagnosis no parent wants for their child, it has completely altered our lives and given us a community and direction and just a total astonishment for all of our children, knowing now, you know, that each milestone and each little uptick in development is really a victory.
So you are an advocate for not just people knowing about CMV, but for testing of women who are pregnant, testing newborns, just being added into the routine. We're tested for so many things while we're pregnant, and babies are tested for so many things when they're born these days. And the fact that this has been known for so long and was not brought out into the forefront really until you started talking about it, until, just think, if somebody who wasn't you didn't have the wherewithal or the you know, the courage and the strength, it's the word I'm looking for, to actually not just help your daughter, but find out why this happened, what can be done. And again, it goes through, you know, when you said you're in a rural area and you talked about your doctor, it reminds me, and you might not have heard of this, the old Marcus Welby, the old doctor, it was a show, yeah, Josh Brolin, who's married to Barbara Streisand. Well, his father played Marcus Welby.
Okay.
The doctor that everyone, he made house calls, but he knew everyone. And that makes a difference when you have a doctor who is interested in their patient, mm-hmm. and wants to know about their patient, their environment, and so on, and is not just fixing a bad back.
Right. And Dr. Sharon, she talks about this, that the cost of not knowing the patient means a breakdown in the trust between the patient and the doctor, and the doctor and the patient, and then they don't follow through with taking their medication. They miss appointments, they detach from the possibility of being healed, and then healing doesn't happen. One thing to just backtrack a second, I actually have really complex feelings about testing pregnant women. Okay. I do think that there are certain situations in which women should be tested during pregnancy, but routinely testing is a bit controversial. And here's why. Testing during pregnancy is not, let's see, how do I put it? The testing is subject to a lot of false positives. So those tests can actually really terrify women when there might be a possibility that their child will, you know, be born fairly typical and they didn't even contract CMV recently anyways. There's two different antibody results that come up. One is short-term and one is long-term. And the problem with CMV is that there's many strains of it. So even if you have long-term immunity to CMV, long-term antibodies, it does not mean that you're fully immune. You can still catch a new strain of it. And often doctors are not educated enough to read those results and then counsel their patients about them. Time after time, I have had friends come to me with their antibody results during pregnancy and think they're either fine or think that they're, you know, experiencing a recent case of CMV. And so there are certain things that should trigger a CMV test during pregnancy. Those are things like intrauterine growth restrictions, high drops. It's like the occurrence of extra fluid in the pregnancy by ultrasound, asymmetry in the brain ventricles. And then there's a number of things after birth, like enlarged liver, spleen, which you can also see sometimes in utero, seizures, failed hearing tests, microcephaly, which my daughter had. And so when any of those exhibit themselves, present themselves, then a CMV test should be administered during pregnancy. And that woman should be followed very closely with an MFM. There's some emerging evidence that antivirals during pregnancy can stop the virus from transmitting to the fetus. And so that's one reason that if there are visible issues, then people can opt to take that antiviral. Now, in newborns, totally different. We are pushing the CMV community and many states. There's three states right now that test all of their newborns automatically for CMV. And those states are New York, they're doing a one-year pilot, Connecticut, and Minnesota. Maine is probably soon to follow. We're proposing that in Colorado. And then there's four Canadian provinces who test all their newborns for CMV because, like I said earlier, there is this treatment. And not only that, but if we start this conversation during pregnancy, then even if we aren't testing during pregnancy, then the babies who are diagnosed at birth, it is already in that child's paperwork that CMV is a potential reason for any anomalies and they should be considered for treatment right away. Otherwise, this silence is what's leading to a lack of diagnoses in newborns and a lack of treating them. And, you know, it might be that one day we have a more sensitive test during pregnancy and we have a more effective treatment during pregnancy. But until then, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't discuss it. I mean, that's just not how our society works. In no case ever has restricting knowledge been the answer to growing humans. And it certainly isn't the case here. So
I understand that. And I fully agree with you on that. But if we could backtrack a minute, toddlers, especially in daycare situations, can be the carriers without any symptoms. So we could go without ever knowing that a toddler gave it to another toddler who could give it to whatever, because I've never, truthfully, until I read your book, I'd never heard of it. And my children had been in daycare many, many years ago. They're in their 30s now. And so how does one even begin to think about that if they have a toddler that, and in a daycare situation, that might be something that they could wind up catching from their toddler?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing to keep in mind is this has been going on since the beginning of time. Humans have always had CMV. And so just knowing about your risk can feel like it heightens your risk, but it's actually the opposite. It's actually totally the inverse. When you know about it, and you know that you are in a high risk situation, which is pregnancy, then there are these, you know, very implementable things that you can do.
Like washing your hands?
Like just washing your hands more, truly. And as COVID has shown us, behavioral intervention works. It's not something that doctors love to, you know, recommend because it's not as concrete as a drug or an intervention, and people can be faulty with implementing interventions. And yet now we see that they work. And so, you know, with the children that I had after Anna during those pregnancies, they just knew. It was just a transparent thing in our house. I get my own water bottle, you get yours. Do not touch my chapstick, that is mine. and I think like after COVID, some of those things are a little bit more natural for us anyways. Like we really don't need to be kissing our toddlers on the mouth when we're pregnant. Like crazy viruses can show up and you really don't want that. And, you know, there's been some criticism. In particular, one pretty vocal doctor in Australia said that this impacts maternal bonding. It doesn't at all. And there have been multiple studies on women who have said 90% of them in the US and in other countries say they want to know about CMV and they would do what is required of them to potentially prevent contracting the virus. And so this stuff is, you know, it's basically universal precautions. So actually healthcare workers are at no higher risk of contracting CMV because they wash their hands all the time and they are trained to avoid bodily fluids. So CMV does not transmit through the air. You have to get saliva or urine directly in your mouth, which is why mothers are at risk and why daycare workers are at risk. So that's actually a huge problem, is that often people who work at daycare centers or have in-home daycare centers and become pregnant are not aware of that risk. And there's a number of mothers whose children have been stillborn because they've been working around so many toddlers during their entire pregnancy that they're constantly ingesting that virus through, you know, contact with the saliva, you know, in their mouth, just as the day goes on, you know, wiping a kid's nose and then eating lunch or whatever. And so while it is an inconvenient truth, it is a truth and it always has been. And, you know, when you look at the world and you see how many children have issues that could be connected to CMV, because it can cause behavioral issues and sleep issues and, you know, all kinds of things that we see in children through their development, then you might think, yeah, this is ubiquitous. And maybe it's more visible than anybody is saying. So I think, you know, it's touchy, but it needs to be said because it just is.
Well, so many things are touchy. And look what happens when we say it's going to be uncomfortable, so let's not talk about it.
Right.
Not a good place to be in.
Right. And, you know, the cost is
huge.
Yeah. And it's in our children. And that's not fair. If there's something that we could be giving them to ensure that their environment in utero is the best it can be, then we want to look back and say, I provided everything that I could. And this either happened anyways, or it didn't. And I had a relationship with my doctor that was transparent and healthy.
Megan, I want to thank you for your advocacy. As you said, you mentioned the states that already are putting this into practice, and hopefully Maine will be next. The book is Remedies for Sorrow, An Extraordinary Child, A Secret Kept from Pregnant Women, and A Mother's Pursuit of the Truth. Megan, where can people find out more about you?
You can go to my website, which is Megan, M-E-G-A-N, Nix, N-I-X.com, or I'm on Instagram under Remedies for Sorrow.
Megan, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This is a very, very important conversation. So I thank you for putting it out there and for the work that you've been doing since Anna was born. And as I said, Anna's in mainstream school now.
Yeah, she's
fine language. She's talking.
Yeah, she's great. She's a marvel. But thank you so much for reading and for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.